Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. I predict that this is one you will never forget. Professor Guy McPherson has been studying climate change since the mid-1980s, and he has some extreme predictions to share with us today. Notably, that humanity may be extinct on this planet as soon as 2030. Now that's not consistent with the consensus, which many people consider to be too conservative. And Guy McPherson will explain his dire predictions in this in-depth interview.
Well, I'm standing by a river, but the water doesn't flow. It boils with every poison you can think of. And I'm underneath the streetlight, but the light of joy I know is scared beyond belief. Down in the shadows, and the perverted fear of violence chokes the smile on every face, and common sense is ringing out the bell. This ain't no technological breakdown. Oh no, this is the road.
British blues man Chris Ray with our opening music today. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions, including the great artist Siri Walgren, Marvin Rasmussen, Abby McMillan, and Paul Karsh. They each kick in $5 to $20 a month. You can do it too. Visit peterbcollins.com. Click on menu, then click on become a subscriber, and I believe you can take it from there. Thanks for listening, and send your comments to Peter@peterbcollins.com. I'm Peter B. Collins. Welcome to my latest conversation here on Marin TV. And let me note that we are recording on Earth Day, and Mother Earth is in trouble. Guy McPherson joins us here. He is a professor emeritus from the University of Arizona of Natural Resources, Ecology, and Evolutionary Biology. He has been on the climate change patrol since?
Since the mid-1980s, when I was a graduate student, is when I first began studying anthropogenic climate change.
And was it related to peak oil initially?
No. I had no clue that there was such a thing as peak oil in the mid-1980s.
And what was the evidence or the data that drew your attention?
The driving force of that time, as I was studying field ecology, I was looking for explanations behind historical recruitment patterns. Why are there so many of this kind of tree and they're all about the same age? Why are we missing these ages or these cohorts of this particular species? So I went back in time, looked at the weather records that got me onto the track of looking at climate more generally. And next thing you know, I'm studying climate change and how it affects ecosystems. And so that was my primary push those nearly 40 years ago.
Interesting. And you don't shy away from controversy, and I think our viewers are going to understand that by the end of this half hour. What do you see as the sources of the controversy that follows your work? Is it because you're outspoken and you look at the data and analyze it according to your scientific principles? Is that why people find you
Yeah, I think that has a large part to do with it. I'm a conservation biologist. I've taught courses in conservation biology, and that's really what I called myself, as a conservation biologist. The three pillars underpinning conservation biology are speciation, how and with what predecessors a species comes into existence, extinction, when the last individual of a species dies, and habitat. And I've been studying habitat and what it requires to maintain habitat for a particular species for a long time. I'm pretty lonely in that experience studying climate change from the perspective of a conservation biologist. Most climate scientists are physicists or astronomers or some field that is pretty far removed from life, much less human life on Earth. So when I view humans, our species, Homo sapiens, as another animal species, I get a lot of flack for that because we're such a special animal, apparently, that we shouldn't be lumped into the general category of animal.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. McPherson, I am not as well-versed in these issues as you are. I'm a generalist. I've interviewed many people who've written books about climate change, and so I have perhaps a better understanding than the average news consumer, but I don't pretend to be an expert. As I've been informed, the warming of the oceans, the melting of the permafrost, and drought that appears to be coming perpetual in some regions of the world are some of the, you know, most serious concerns that we look at. And particularly with the ocean warming and the permafrost, there is the pronounced risk of a feedback loop multiplier, where the estimates of how long we have before San Francisco is underwater, how long we have before the San Joaquin Valley is a region that can't sustain the crops. This is where, you know, there we do see some dispute. So it's the rate that we're arguing about more than any issues of the underlying factors. Is that?
That's absolutely correct. And I have become known for my work on abrupt climate change, which specifically addresses the rate of change. And so we're no longer in the time of Al Gore-style linear gradual climate change. Those days are behind us. There's historical precedents in planetary history for abrupt climate change, albeit not with humans on the planet. Mm-hmm. And we are now clearly in the midst of abrupt, irreversible climate change. And so that has attracted a lot of attention to me, most of it negative, but it is what it is.
You seem able to handle it.
So far.
Yeah.
Every day's a new day.
Are you in therapy?
No, I'm not. You know, I've tried therapy several times, and after a few visits, it becomes clear that there's only so much I can do for the therapist. And so I just give up on that.
So when we look at this rate of decline, the rate of you know, significant shift toward extinction, what is the proper way to evaluate that? And take a couple of minutes here, please, to explain to our viewers what some of your analysis and predictions are based on.
Sure. So, for example, according to a paper by James Hansen and colleagues that came out in 2017, we are currently experiencing the hottest Earth ever with our species on it. So you could argue that it's a little surprising we made it this long with habitat for humans on Earth. Within the last week, as we speak, which is 3 or 4 weeks by the time this show airs, there's a major report out of Europe that is a synthetic work that indicates we need to be very concerned about crossing the 1.5 degrees Celsius border, if you will.
And that's compared to what year?
Compared to the 1750 baseline.
Okay.
So the paper indicated, and it has multiple authors, indicated that if we breach 1.5 degrees above the 1750 baseline, when the global average temperature was about 13.5 degrees Celsius. So meaning when we get up to about 15 degrees Celsius, that itself might cause extinction of human beings. Now, that's a little awkward because 2 years ago, we were at 1.75 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline, which this paper fails to acknowledge. So it could be that we have already reached the point at which humans are slowly going to go extinct because of loss of habitat. And we see evidence of that all over the planet with refugee crisis on the United States southern border, refugee crisis in Western Europe when I was there speaking 4 years ago from the Middle East and Northern Africa, people fleeing small island states in the South Pacific, people moving entire communities upslope in Alaska in the United States. So it could be that that's playing out already. Or it could be that it will take a significant event to cause more heating and therefore accelerate the rate of human extinction. But keep in mind that we've known for many years now, based on the work of atmospheric scientist Tim Garrett from the University of Utah, now chair of the atmospheric sciences program there, civilization is a heat engine. No matter how we run the thing, civilization itself, industrial civilization, is heating the planet. Wave power, wind power, whatever you want to throw at it, it's heating the planet. So much so that a paper by Rosenfeld and colleagues in the January, no, it was not Rosenfeld and colleagues, I'm sorry about that. A paper published December 26th of 2018 indicates that we're headed for climates 2 to 3 degrees warmer than we're currently experiencing Earth in 2030.
Now,
that rate of change is astonishing.
This is really inconvenient, okay, because I've always believed that this was always going to happen after I've left the planet.
Right.
And I'm a little disturbed that you're messing with my equilibrium.
Well, and I'm sorry about that. And it's not just your equilibrium, it's mine too. I'm no fan of connecting the dots for people and indicating that the global average temperature is going to rise beyond our ability to adapt in the not very distant future. People don't appreciate that about me, and I don't appreciate being the one saying it. But as a scientist and a teacher, I feel it's my professional obligation to connect a few of the obviously connected dots.
Yeah. So 2030, what do you see at that stage? Will humans start to drop dead because the planet can't sustain them?
I'd be stunned, shocked, and amazed if there were a human being on the planet in 2030.
A single?
Not one.
Really?
If there is a human being on the planet at that point, he or she will be alternatively too hot and too cold, bathing in ionizing radiation from the 450 and change nuclear power plants around the world that melted down, thirsty, dehydrated, hungry, living in a bunker surrounded by the bodies of like-minded sociopaths.
Wow.
That's my best guess at the glorious future that lies ahead for people who are interested in living on an essentially lifeless planet.
So let me unpack this a little bit. One of the things you mentioned there is nuclear power plants. Mm-hmm. There are people like Stuart Brand, who's well-known here in Marin County, who shifted a few years ago and said, well, nuclear power is better than coal and gas, and while it does throw off heat, and we use a lot of water to absorb that heat, there's no smokestack, therefore no carbon, therefore we consider it a less worse alternative.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, we can go around and around on what's the lesser of the evils, but the lesser of the evils is still evil. We learn nothing from Three Mile Island. We learn nothing from Chernobyl. We learn nothing from Fukushima, which I suspect is an extinction-level event in and of itself for humans, albeit over the span of multiple generations, because it's the multi-generational horrors resulting from lethal mutations that come into play when we're talking about ionizing radiation. It takes so much concrete to build the cooling towers for nuclear power facilities that they don't become carbon neutral for a few decades, by which time they're unsafe. It's time to shut them down. because they have become unsafe. Mm-hmm. So how about instead of constantly demanding more electricity, more power, more of everything, you know, one approach would be to try to live with less, but apparently that's beyond the pale for almost any of us here on Earth. And then what also comes into play is something called the aerosol masking effect or global dimming, the catch-22 of abrupt climate change that essentially no media outlet, essentially no paid climate scientist, and no government entity will talk or write about. The aerosol masking effect is tremendous, and if we reduce burning of fossil fuels, if we reduce industrial activity by as little as 35%, that can drive a global average temperature rise of 1°C within a matter of days or weeks. There's no way our species or almost any other species on Earth can adapt to that rate of change. So this push to reduce emissions that I hear about all the time from folks involved with Extinction Rebellion, for example, that's a terrible idea. This is the catch-22. We reduce emissions, that means the particulates fall out of the sky, the aerosols specifically, that are reflecting incoming sunlight before they have a chance to heat Earth. If we get rid of those aerosols, the first paper I came across that dealt with this issue was by James Hansen and colleagues, December 2011, and they indicated a 1.2 plus or minus 0.2 degree global average temperature rise. And then the paper by Levy and colleagues comes out in 2013 indicating that as little as 35% reduction in industrial activity drives a 1 degree global average temperature rise. We're toast. We're done if that happens. So
we're screwed if we address it, and we're screwed if we don't.
Exactly. So we're producing all these greenhouse gases that have the potential right now to heat the planet far beyond what the genus Homo and the species Sapiens have ever experienced if we stop right now. But if we stop right now, all those aerosols fall out of the sky and heat the planet even faster. Doomed if you do, doomed if you don't, to turn the phrase.
Yeah. So there is no way out? Is that essentially your conclusion?
Yes.
Science doesn't offer us any palliatives?
I think what we have at this point is planetary hospice. Speaking of palliative, I think we have palliative end-of-life care, and I believe that's the route we should be pursuing. Mm-hmm. I don't see any way out. I'm not opposed to people trying to find the miracle solution, and I don't think it's coming. Civilization is a heat engine. We know this from the peer-reviewed journal literature, and reducing civilization is sufficient to cause overheating beyond what we're already experiencing. So I don't see a way out of this mess, although I'm a huge fan of people trying to find a way out of this mess, because as with you, I'm no fan of this inconvenient message.
All right, let me try this. I showed you this book before we started recording, and your first response was to hand it back to me. And then you were kind enough to open and look at a few pages. This was prepared by a group of architects under the direction of Vanessa Keith. She's based in New York. And it is rich with graphic expression. And it ultimately leads to a set of blueprints for adaptation for human survival on the planet. And in a thumbnail, it basically posits that Vancouver and Moscow will be the most livable cities on the planet, and that we have to move into high-density housing and population control, and that there would be what she called extractive towns, where the renewable energy is produced and then delivered to the locations that have survived. And it's based on a premise of only 4 degrees warming by 2100. So, is there an adaptation of this plan for adaptation that makes any sense to you? If the timeline were shifted, and if, you know, we brought to bear the resources to make significant change, or are the issues you described before, the damned if we do, damned if we don't, pretty well set in stone, and this would be virtuous activity that would give us hope as we face extinction?
I think the latter is correct. I think that there are two very large ifs you mentioned there. If we can stretch the timeline to 2100, and if we can come up with the resources to invest in such an endeavor. Well, we're pretty much at peak everything, according to a now old book by Richard Hindberg titled Peak Everything. So I'm not sure where these resources are going to come from. And I just don't see that timeline as being reasonable at all.
What if it were 2050 or even 2040? Can we delay the arrival of the Grim Reaper?
There is no known way to delay, much less stop, abrupt climate change. Even Bill McKibben, whose organization is funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, admitted a few years ago that there's no stopping this runaway train. And it didn't receive a lot of attention.
Well, his new book is pretty much more in line with your thinking, is how I'd put it.
Yes, and it also throws out the 2100 canard. In my opinion, that's a way to assure people that it's all going to be fine because your children and your grandchildren are going to deal with it. And in my mind, that discourages action because hope or the belief in a favorable future, when you look at it from an evidentiary perspective, actually causes people to not do anything. You know, if the United States, if almost everybody in the United States in the 1930s and 1940s had hope that everything would turn out just fine, I suspect we'd all be speaking German now. That's where hope takes us. It actually negates action. It doesn't encourage action. So what worked in World War II? The Manhattan Project. Why did it work? Fear. You want to motivate people to act. Strike fear into their hearts. Don't throw hope at them.
Well, I certainly don't dispute the power of fear. It's been marshaled for domestic politics very effectively and increasingly over the last 19 years, if not longer. But I think that there is a limit to how much people can absorb and actually respond to. And the most immediate fear is the one that an average person is most likely to be responsive to.
Right. And I'm not trying to invoke fear. I'm actually encouraging people to remain calm. One of my signature lines is remain calm, nothing is under control. Because as nearly as I can tell, nobody is in control. And if anybody is, it's certainly not me and you. So I think calm is an appropriate strategy. Mm-hmm. Not fear, not shame, not blame, not hope, but to take actions that we think are relevant with the people in our lives that matter to us, who matter to us, instead of fearing or hoping for the future that never comes.
Mm-hmm. But psychologically, how do we overcome the entrenched deniers who are extremely well-funded? And it's pretty clear to me that over the last 5 to 7 years, things have shifted. They've been able to create more doubt than existed, say, in 2010.
Absolutely. How do we do, I hate to be the one to break this to you, but we're all going to die. The deniers too. The people who have been claiming that they are taking action or promoting other people to take actions. The people like me who were crapping in a bucket for a decade, living off grid, taking the actions that so few people were willing to take. We're all going to die. And it's going to be a lot faster than most people can possibly imagine. Way faster than anything resembling a solution is going to be put into play, put mm-hmm. into a sort of operating procedure. I read every day about how we're going to start capturing carbon from the atmosphere and a thousand other, Hawkins' book, Drawdown, is all the rage because it presumes that somebody else is going to do something at a very large scale. And in fact, that somebody else is going to do hundreds of things that will fix this predicament that we find ourselves embroiled in. But I don't see that happening. I don't see relying upon hope or fear for the future that we cannot adequately predict as being appropriate motivating forces. So remain calm. Nothing is under control.
And what's your own personal plan for the next 11, 12 years?
I've been encouraging people for many years, and I'm trying to follow this path myself. I encourage living fully. I encourage living with intention.
Well, excuse me, I'm going to go buy an Escalade and load it up with coal.
I'm not going to judge. At the edge of extinction, why should we judge? Why should we blame? Why should we shame people? There's no reason for any of that. Let's live fully. I suspect we were locked into abrupt, irreversible climate change at about the time you and I were born. It was in 1965 that the chief of the American Petroleum Institute, at their annual convention, at their annual meeting, Frank Eichard said, "It's almost too late. We are running out of time to deal with burning fossil fuels." That's 1965. I was 5 years old. What could I do? So I did what everybody did in Weipe, Idaho at that time when I was growing up. I pursued going faster. I pursued getting a personal automobile. I got on the bus to go to school. I did what everybody else did, and now everybody doing what everybody else did got us into this intractable mess that we're in. So if you want to buy that Escalade and have it be coal-powered, knock yourself out. In fact, you could argue that the aerosols that you put into the atmosphere act as a mirror reflecting incoming sunlight back into space. You're saving the day, man. Thanks.
Guy, help me with something. I've been doing radio and TV for a long time, and I have a pretty strong following worldwide. This interview will be heard in 70 countries. And many of the more conspiratorial-minded people keep telling me that I need to expose chemtrails, that geoengineering as a secret plan being executed by our government is going on a daily basis. And I'm not allergic to conspiratorial investigations, but I've never found any substantial evidence, a credible whistleblower, or something that persuades me that this is more than a YouTube preaching to the choir phenomenon. Can you give me your evaluation?
And I couldn't agree more with you.
Is there any potential for, changing the atmosphere in an effort to protect us from advanced climate change?
Well, I completely agree with you. I've seen no evidence to support the notion of any nefarious beings or organizations out there spraying the skies to protect us or to kill us, one or the other. The story seems to change depending upon the telling. Are there things that could be done? The United States National Academy of Sciences in the summer of 2015 did a major assessment of geoengineering techniques proposed up till that point. A European body of similar stature duplicated the effort at about the same time, and they both concluded the same thing. Geoengineering is likely to not only not improve the situation, but likely make it worse. So the science says, supported by the peer-reviewed literature, that there is nothing to be done that will reverse this, what is clearly irreversible climate change at this point.
Your natural resources background has led you to be a professional witness in many wildfire and forest fire investigations and liability determinations. Give us a thumbnail on the recent wildfires in Northern California.
Well, they're historic to the point of being biblical, and I'm not much into the Bible, don't get me wrong. And they are a harbinger of what's to come. You know, there was an episode on an HBO program that I never watched called The Newsroom, I think it was. It was written by Aaron Sorkin. Mm-hmm. And there's a little four-minute clip in which the anchor is interviewing this expert from the federal government. And he's talking about what we are already seeing, wildfires way too big for humans to counter. It takes a major weather event to put those fires out. It doesn't take human beings. We're at that point now. And he listed several others, floods. Look at the what's being called the land hurricane in the Midwestern United States.
Yeah.
Something that almost nobody imagined would happen. In fact, most climate scientists and me agreed or foresaw a major drought constricting the interior of the United States. Instead, what we see is, surprise, surprise, the climate scientists are surprised again. We're seeing a land hurricane that is causing such a spoiling of the stored grain crops that whether we'll have grains in the coming year remains to be seen, because they're underwater. And that the planting has been pushed back. 80% of the planting of grains that should be in place right now has been delayed at least. How long can we delay that? The growing season is finite. Mm-hmm. And it's been reliable for the last few thousand years. And now suddenly it's not reliable. That does not bode well for a set of living arrangements that depends upon the ability to grow, store, and distribute grains at scale.
Guy McPherson, people can follow your work at Nature Bats Last. That's your blog.
GuyMcPherson.com is the easy way to get there, yes.
Okay, great. And I'd like to buy you dinner on Earth Day 2030. Will you meet me?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
In fact, I'll buy you dinner.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
A
pleasure to meet you.
Appreciate it.